Let's talk.
John Brown. Injury time. Football in a state of emergency is a sharp and thought-provoking look at contemporary British society through the lens of football. It is by David Goldblatt. He's been described by none other than Dominic Sandbrook as, quote-unquote, possibly the best football historian there has ever been. This is one hell of an intro. I'd like to say that David joins me live on the line now. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
How do you follow an intro like that?
Pretty tricky, actually. It's not a bad calling card.
So for those who don't know of you, just explain a little bit why you are eminently qualified to write this particular tome.
Well, I've been in this groove for about 25 years. Back in the early 2000s, I published a sort of reinvention of the football encyclopedia as a 750-page infographic atlas of global football, maps, diagrams and bar charts in club colours. And then I graduated to The Ball is Round, which I published in 2006, A Global History of Football, which is 1,000 pages long and is the entire history of modern football, sporting, social, political, cultural, technological, and in its own way, a shadow history of modernity. And then in 2014, I sort of came home and wrote a book about English football called The Game of Our Lives, The Making and Meaning of English Football, which brought the story up to about 2012. And here we are, just over a decade later. The United Kingdom has been through the most kind of extraordinary series of percussive changes, crises and transformations. And football has tracked that. So I think I'm in a reasonably good position to have a stab at writing what is, in effect, a state of the nation book about Britain through the lens of football.
Why does football, rather than, say, tennis, rugby league, cricket, reflect the state of a nation, you know, in the way that the other sports don't?
I mean, I think the comparison, to be honest, is not rugby league and tennis, and no disrespect to the people who play and love those games, but nobody cares. You know, these are minority cultural pursuits of the most marginal cultural and political significance. The comparator is other whole zones of popular culture. You know, why is football a better measure than music or art or the novel or television even? And I think the answer is partly because football is such a multifaceted thing. You know, first and foremost, it's a game that people play before we get to anything else. And more people are playing more kinds of football in Britain today than for a very, very long time. More people are volunteering in football than any other social practice or organisation in Britain. I mean, football has, you know, what, maybe 10 times more volunteers than the whole of the Scout movement. And, you know, Baden-Powell is turning in his grave, you know, finding that out. The National Trust is like a fragment of the voluntary effort of football. So at that scale, it's part of the warp and weft of everyday life that, you know, very few other things are. But beyond that, football is also an extraordinary ritual in a way that most other sports aren't. You know, millions of people, and I should say more people are going to see professional football today in Britain, which now goes quite a long way down the pyramid. More people are going to see professional football than at any time in history. Even the great post-war peak of 1951, when there was nothing else to do in miserable austerity Britain, we are now exceeding that. And you know, football is an extraordinary ritual in which people kind of measure out and make meaning of their lives and tell their own personal and their own neighbourhood and locality's narratives through the experience of their football team. Football is also the most sensational soap opera. You know, football is a multi-stranded story, you know, multiple interacting characters. It's got a cliffhanger every week. What will happen next week? Will we be better? Will we win? Will we lose? And where the kind of wall between reality and the and the fiction is actually very fluid. And like soap opera in its heyday, it's something that we actually watch communally, not individually. It's the thing that we talk about all week. And even if, you know, you don't like it and you don't watch it, just like with Coronation Street and Enders back in the day, you kind of know what's going on and you know who the main characters are and the names and addresses in the show are. So it is with football today. Add to that that football is also the most sensational public theatre. You know, football is put out in the world and on show versions of ourselves that are often hidden or hard to see. I mean, what else do we do in large numbers in public, you know, apart from riot and protest these days? This is makes football at all of these levels is the equal or exceeds church attendance, theatre attendance, you know, and it sure as hell is not the soap operas to hell off the schedules. I mean, I think, you know, an interesting reversal there is that in 2001, EastEnders were showing a 45-minute special in which it would be revealed who had shot Phil Mitchell. And it turned out that there was a round of 16 Champions League game on ITV at the same time, kicking off at 8 o'clock. And therefore, EastEnders would run 15 minutes into the Champions League game. So the BBC wrote to UEFA and ITV and said, would you mind delaying kickoff by 15 minutes? And unbelievably, such was the relative cultural weight and power of the institutions at that time, that they did delay the kickoff for 15 minutes. In 2022, during the Qatar World Cup, soaps were completely banished from the broadcast schedule to accommodate the World Cup and ended up being, you know, lost somewhere out on iPlayer. What an extraordinary turnaround. And these days, I should say, you know, a big game on Sky, and if you add in all the pirate streams, is, you know, is outperforming any episode of EastEnders or Coronation Street.
I mean, can we argue, to paraphrase Marx, you know, football is the opium of the people, because no matter how bad the world is outside, for 90 minutes or the build-up and the breakdown afterwards, you get away from your ordinary life.
Well, I think that's one element of it. I mean, I think people consume and enjoy and engage with football at multiple levels. And one of them is distraction and one of them is escapism. And that's absolutely part of the agenda. But I would say that is just a fragment of what is going on. People are celebrating their identity. People are renewing and engaging in social networks. I mean, for myself, when I go to football, you know, the shiver that passes down my spine as I walk to the football stadium is the thought that anything can happen. You know, football's a space of extraordinary and unexpected activity and theatre. It has a kind of, you know, excitement. And I often find, actually, it engages me with the world rather than escaping it. It opens up a reading on who and what we are. I mean, it's impossible not to engage with, you know, modern English football and not see it, at least in part, as a public theatre of racism and anti-racism. I mean, that's what's going on inside those stadiums. You know, there is, as we know, a continuing presence of racist behaviour and attitudes, which most white people will never see, but is actually on show publicly inside a football stadium. And at the same time, you have acts of public anti-racism and challenge to that, be it, you know, Raheem Sterling's incredible posts on Instagram in the issue or the taking of the knee, back at it. And I'm, you know, that's not escaping from the world. That's actually just like jumping right deep into it.
But had you suggested in the 70s and the 80s that football would mirror all society and you would have mixed, or, you know, you have a diverse audience, you know, spectators, because you need only need to pan around the grounds and you will see, you know, the whole of life is there. But if you had suggested in the 70s and 80s that, you know, football had a relevance to society, reflected society, you would have been very scared indeed, wouldn't you? Because of the way that football was not a communal occasion that you would kind of want to get involved because of the violence and the inherent in the stands, etc. Or are you going to shoot me down on that one, David?
No,
I mean, the transformation's been quite incredible, hasn't it? Is that Italian 90 and 96 when the whole Britpop culture meshed and clashed and it was all, you know, it was taken on board?
And people sort of often ask these questions as if it's sort of a surprise that things should have changed. And the way I look at it is to say that in the 1970s and 1980s, British football is still a quintessentially working class industrial institution, you know, born in the, you know, created certainly in its kind of working class commercial spectacle form in the 1870s and 1880s, and in some ways, you know, kind of unchanged. And we know that society, that economy, for both good and ill, has been irredeemably smashed over the last 50 years. And a very different, more complex, and more varied post-industrial society has grown up on its ruins. And we shouldn't be surprised, therefore, that on the one hand, there is enormous change, both in terms of who goes, how they behave, what it looks like on the pitch. But I think the thing that simultaneously is so amazing about English football is that it continues to be a long, loving, romantic goodbye, and in some ways pantomime recreation of those lost worlds. You know, we still talk about players' wages. Like, really? Like a 10 bob note in a brown envelope in a metal bashing plant in West Bromwich in 1950. That's wages. You know, what they're getting today are not wages. They're getting salaries, or they're getting exotic loans in the British Virgin Islands as a tax avoidance device. But we maintain the fiction that we're still somehow in the 1950s or 60s. Or my other favourite is that we refer to, you know, the boss as the gaffer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, Arsene Wenger is Jose Mourinho is a gaffer.
Pep Guardiola, like, exactly, yeah.
Gaffer's the dude on the building site in Camden in the 1970s who's in charge of ordering you around. Like, that is not what is going on, but we maintain this sort of touching illusion that world is still with us. And, you know, I think that's really important, because actually, while that world was a world of, you know, racism and toxic masculinity, and in the football, often violence, it was also a world that was much more egalitarian, much happier, which had deep-rooted solidarities and identities produced and reproduced in football. And that was a beautiful thing, and we still hunger for it. I mean, what else? Why else are people, you know, 10,000 people going to see Bristol Rovers, my local club, where I can tell you it's about neither art nor winning? There is a deep hunger in this country for being part of something bigger than oneself. And there are very few opportunities actually to do so. And football is one of those places.
It's all about community, isn't it? It's all about being part of something bigger than yourself. And maybe one of the other things which is really, really interesting is if you look at the international aspects of football now, you've got managers and players from all over the, you know, they're not, I mean, we used to think, you know, a Scottish player was exotic for goodness sake. And I remember, as you probably will do, you know, because, you know, Ardiles and Ricardo, what was his name? Ricky Villas coming over. Yeah, exactly. And they were like, they were incredible because they were from Argentina, and everybody, oh my goodness,
out of space, man.
Basically, yeah. But if you look at the international makeup of teams, managers, etc. Now, and yet you have a UK that is taking a step away from being closely integrated to Europe, and we have some really interesting political sort of situations. How does that represent itself then, David, on you know, as part of society? You know, we're an international, welcoming football community, and yet you know, send them back on boats, etc. How does that one square up?
Well, as I often think of the Brexiteers' argument, it's you can leave the European Union, but you can't leave global capitalism. And they're not the same thing. They tried to hoodwink us that it was, but it's not. And the Premier League, in particular, though increasingly lower levels of English football, is bound to a global capitalist economy, not the European Union. And we haven't left that. If anything, we are more dependent, more integrated over it, with ever less control. I mean, at least the European Union offered some sliver of supranational authority by which global capital might conceivably be challenged. But we're now we're going solo and taking on the bond markets all by ourselves and discovering actually that the British state, whatever its imperial origins and pomp, is not capable of dealing with that. And I think, you know, in that regard, the Premier League in particular is a pretty good analogy for what's happened to great swathes of the British economy. We sold off the family silver, you know, and look what we got. You know, water industry, step forward. Railway industry, step forward. You know, 70 to 90% owned by foreigners who have not invested in it, who have absolutely ripped off these assets, sweated them. I mean, in the case of, you know, the water industry, as you probably know, more than 50 billion pounds have been extracted, you know, in dividends for companies that have been systematically polluting the country, and, you know, who haven't built a reservoir in 35 years. And this is broadly what we're getting in football. You know, we sold off the family silver. It wasn't collectively owned, but we sold it off, and now we've got an economy that is overwhelmingly owned by foreign oligarchs, you know, sovereign funds of other states, other people's, you know, other people's nationalized industries, and now increasingly American private equity, you know, who now own dozens of clubs in English football. So, you know, no wonder we abandoned, you know, there has been, you know, the conversation in Britain for 40 years is, you know, private sector good, foreign private sector even better, no questions asked, please come in and buy stuff. Mm. You know, the illusion is that it's an investment, but it's not an investment. You know, what are people investing in? What are they building? You know, I mean, the UAE have basically been given the Etihad, which cost the taxpayer back in, you know, 25 years ago, £200 million. Now probably would cost more than £1 billion to build. And they've basically given it. You know, West Ham United have the Olympic Stadium, you know, now owned partly by Brits, partly by a Czech oligarch. You know, and they're paying a peppercorn rent on it. And they've basically got billions of pounds worth of sunk public sector money. We all pay for it. This is, you know, if you just let these people in, they will take you for a ride.
And of course, when you see sort of the fans, I'm thinking Man United with the old, what is it, green and yellow scarves. It is the average man railing against global capitalism. Then, if you want to get deep and meaningless, David.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting. In a lot of time, there's been no resistance to this, and fair enough. You know, people are going to the football, as you say, because, like, they really don't want to think about global capitalism. You know, they want to think about football, and rightly so. And so, you know, football fans in England, it's been a long, slow process to sort of stir them. You have to, but it's a measure of just how awful some of these owners are that actually you have begun to see mass outbreaks of protest. It's not just at Manchester United. I mean, you know, errant and useless foreign owners like Di Yonga at Reading, who ran the club into the ground, or West Brom have had a similar problem with a Chinese owner. You had incredible protests at Cardiff when Vincent Tan, a Malaysian oligarch, you know, who by his own admission knew nothing about football, wanted Cardiff to play in red rather than blue. Ooh. After 100 years in blue. And they did play in red because, of course, red is a lucky and popular colour in Asia. And it took 2 years of protest for that to be overturned. And then you had the European Super League, you know, where, again, a range of protests, not just at the clubs involved, but other clubs saying, you know, this is unacceptable. So there is... there is a lot of energy. And I think the other kind of amazing sort of political and organisational energy you see in football is in terms of supporters trusts and fan-owned clubs, you know, be it breakaways like FC United or AFC Wimbledon, you know, an extraordinary story, but also the work that they've done at a lot of other clubs rescuing them. Exeter, Luton would be good examples of that. So there is... A lot of energy out there for organising. I mean, I think the same is true of the food bank movement, is that, you know, most big clubs now have a fan-supporting food banks operation where, you know, it makes sense. You've got 10, 20, 50,000 people gathering in one place. Really good idea to have some big wheelie bins. Everybody chucks a can of beans in, whatever. And this was kicked off in Anfield and Goodison by a Liverpool and an Everton fan. And, you know, now they're supplying a quarter of the food to the food banks in Liverpool. I mean, that's a terrible thing that Liverpool needs that many food banks. On the other hand, the sort of intrinsic communitarian generosity of English football crowds, it's like, you know, sometimes our worst selves are on display and sometimes our best selves are on display.
And on display, we talked about Marcus Rashford, we look at Gary Lineker, they've got social media platforms, they've got millions of followers, and they make comments about life. I mean, Rashford in particular, and gets shot down by the government of the time, you know, and they say, oh, they shouldn't be involved in politics. Well, you know, it goes hand in hand. You've got a platform. You've grown up in the community. You probably know more than a politician who's been parachuted into a safe seat.
Well, and, you know, it makes me laugh. You know, footballers shouldn't be involved in politics, but it's okay for the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia as part of an elaborate global diplomatic strategy to buy Newcastle United. Like, please, you could just like really take the hypocrisy elsewhere. And Rashford, yeah, it was magnificent. You know, a magnificent, and it's like, it's not about really, you know, he's a citizen like everybody else, and citizens have their rights to speak out. Why the hell should footballers, you know, or in the case, you know, football pundits, be denied that? And I take my hat off to both of them. And I think seeing, reading, you know, following those stories, Rashford and food poverty, Lineker and the match of the day strike over his critique of the government's language to describe migrants, I thought, yeah, something's changed in the body politic. And it kind of, that's sort of almost what brought me to kind of write the book.
Mm-hmm. What about the women's game? Because that has changed. It used to be a joke, and yet now it is perhaps the best of all of all football at the moment because of the crowds. I mean, the fact they're winning is beside the point, but the way that the crowds have ballooned, it's been embraced. It is young women are getting, as I said, it used to be a joke. Now it is a serious game, getting serious attention, and that has to be the best of us all once again.
It's the most profound and important thing that's happened in English football in the last 20 years. I mean, football has always traded on the notion of being the people's game, the universal game, the game that everyone can play. And yet, you know, since its inception, women have been excluded and actually, you know, deliberately and legalistically excluded in from 1921 till the early 1970s. And... the reemergence of the women's game, because of course it never entirely disappeared, and its growth is without doubt the best thing that's happened to English football. And not just for the women's game, I think it will change the men's game as well. It's brought a whole different way of being and a whole different football culture. And I think that's great. I mean, I think you can have more than one. You know, it's not about replacing the men's game or about the women's game trying to mirror it. You know, it's like horses for courses. You know, great. Absolutely great. And above all, that just more... young women and girls are playing football. You know, that's the meanness, it seems to me, of the ban. It's like playing football is enormously good fun. There's really nothing like it. And like, really, we denied that to half the population on spurious medical grounds and totally spurious moral argument. Like, what the hell, you know?
And of course, in a world where we're worrying about obesity and diet, etc., getting young people off their proverbials and kicking a football around, be they, you know, girls, boys, whatever you're identifying as, it's got to be a good thing, David.
It's sensational. And it's not just, you know, getting the young folks up and running. It's like all the old folks
walking
too.
Football. I mean, walking football, for example.
Exactly. I think that's one of the loveliest and most brilliant innovations of the last decade is, well, I play walking football myself. And it's great. It just takes the whole thing down a couple of gears. So for those of us, you know, who can't quite handle the knocks and the pace, but the kind of the geometry of the game, you know, is still the same. And, you know, it's notable. It doesn't entirely take the edge out of it either. I've noted that, you know, a lot of walking football has to have sin bins.
Yeah, and I've watched walking football and, you know, live and gone, blimey, you know, I was expecting people sedately, but there you go.
So, yes, I think, you know, that and also the innovations of the new five-a-side games, the small-sided game for kids rather than putting, you know, eight-year-olds out on a full-scale 11-a-side pitch. This is all great. You know, we need more coaches. We need to spend money on, I mean, grassroots pitches are in a terrible state. 15 years of austerity and local government retrenchment has absolutely destroyed the quality of a lot of grassroots pitches. And the climate crisis, I should say, is making things five times worse. The amount of rain that we're now getting means that, you know, we're losing hundreds of thousands of games a year to it, and we need to do something about it.
What are you hoping that we've got 30 seconds? What are you hoping that people are going to learn, take, and enjoy from injury time?
That football is an extraordinary soap opera and a place where we can examine our worst selves, but aspire to be our best selves.
The book is called Injury Times by David Goldblatt. David, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure.